Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.
You're listening to a Hindustan Times podcast brought to you by HD Smartcast.
Hi, this is Manjula Narayan, National Books Editor, Hindustan Times, and this is the Books and Authors podcast. It's a weekly podcast where I speak to authors who've got a new book out. Hi, so today we have with us Kalol Bhattacharji, who's written Nehru's First Recruits, The Diplomats Who Built Independent India's Foreign Policy. Hi, Kalol.
Thank you so much, Manjula. Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, Kalol, I found this book really instructive and interesting, of course. You know, I mean, when you're reading about India's foreign policy and all, and your book kind of gives us the root of a lot of the ways that we think as a nation, right, in our foreign policy. So you've taken us back to the early years and, you know, pre-independence even, and all the players then, and you've kind of recreated that whole era and, shown how many of our traditions and the ways of thinking of our foreign policy originally evolved, and from there, you know, one can get a better idea of why certain things are happening now, or how we deal with certain problems now. You know, the similarities and the differences. So I found that great, and it's stuffed with so much detail. So I won't keep gassing. I want you to talk about the book. So tell me, you know, there's so much work that's gone into it. You know, it's really impressive. There's so much anecdote, and, you know, so tell me first of all the origin of this book. You know, let's start with an easy question.
Right. So my thinking about the Indian Foreign Service is basically rooted in my own profession as a journalist who writes and reports on Indian foreign affairs. And I've been doing it now a little more than 2 decades. And I've often felt that, you know, when it comes to the narration of the Indian foreign policy, it's increasingly been done by professional diplomats. Now, that is a bit of it's a bit different from what it was early on, because earlier we still had several, say, political figures who used to come into the narration of Indian foreign policy, Indian strategic postures, etc. And increasingly, we have found that, you know, that these activities are being done by professional diplomats. In fact, the last time we have some sort of a political appointee working as an Indian ambassador was, if I'm correct, Mr. Dr. Karan Singh, who served as an Indian ambassador to the United States in the late 1980s. And ever since, almost all the posts of Indian diplomats or Indian officials and spokespersons, basically people who speak about Indian foreign policy and Indian foreign policy priorities, are mostly manned by the Indian Foreign Affairs professionals, that is the IFS officers. And I have always wondered that this service is so privileged that often we find this other services that we talk about, you know, but we don't get to talk about this particular service. So my curiosity was rooted in studying the social and the cultural evolution of this service. And I started thinking about it way back in 2010 and 11, in fact, when the whole lot of, you know, global upsurge was happening, especially the Arab Spring, where the Indian diplomats were crisscrossing, and there was a lot of crisis airlifting, etc., that was being discussed. You know, we had Libya, Tunisia, all those developments happening. At that time, I thought that, you know, this service, you know, which never really discloses much about itself, is of great curiosity. And that is when I started studying the service. And it seemed to me that one of the main roots of the service is that it is a very elite institution, because it was literally created by the first Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru himself. So, you know, when you are really created by the first Prime Minister and his teammates, you do bring in certain amount of elite orientation in your behavior. And along with it comes also a very great deal of interprofessional secrecy and professional aloofness that we don't find when it comes to other services, say IAS and Indian Revenue Service, Indian Police Service. And also you will never find, you know, scandals or that sort of, other problems that we find in other Indian services, you know, state services with the Indian Foreign Service. Not that these are not happening inside the Indian Foreign Service, but because the service is so closely guarded and so well protected from other outside exposure that outsiders can't really find out much about the service. So it takes a lot of time to get close to the Indian Foreign Service to learn about it. And when I started learning about the service, and I thought that this is a service which has spanned the entire history of Indian independent India's existence from 1947 onwards. And then I wanted to write about the whole journey of this service. And therefore, I had to have some sort of a discipline. And that discipline perhaps took little time in coming across. And that perhaps I found out when I read the history of services. That is the first official directory of the Indian Foreign Service, which is published in 1959. Because that's a very special service book, because it finds all the men and women who were hired in the first decade, not only working in the first decade, but then spread into the subsequent decades till, say, Vajpayee and Manmohan Singh years. So I felt that the entire grand sweep of history that the first generation of the IFS officers itself was really, the story of origin as well as the evolution of the Indian Foreign Service. And that's how the narrative somehow flashed before me. And I felt that this is a compelling story that should be walked into. And that's how I began working on the book. And yes, it took a good deal of time, especially because we had the pandemic in between, where the libraries were closed and, what happened during those two crazy years. I mean, I really didn't have much resources to bank on. But then finally, when the pandemic was over, I went back to the library. And I think, that was the time that was really necessary to complete the project during those days. Yeah.
And this history of services was brought to your attention by Natwar Singh, right?
Yes, I mean, the history of services is part of my friendship, and that is what I talk about in the book, that I went with, I have been a friend of Natwar for the last 18 to 20 years, and we have often exchanged ideas, and it was during one of those discussions that Natwar himself brought up the directory, and he said that, this is a directory that you would like to look at, and I borrowed that directory, and once I saw the directory, the entire body of the human resources that went into the Foreign Service, as well as the historical spread, I of course mentioned that it started from the late 1940s onwards. But then once the history of services was brought to me, I saw that the story actually begins even from much back in time, because you actually go back in the 1919 and 1920s, when the entire lot of the interwar diplomatic affairs was happening, and India was party to those diplomatic initiatives that took place during, 1919, the Paris Peace Conference, for which India also sought reparation from the German government of that time. So, the historical spread of the Indian Foreign Service, therefore, is really, really fascinating, because it is only a country like ours which had this sort of exposure to the global affairs. We, of course, were not a state in 1920 and 1930, but yet we had some sort of foreign affairs, a foreign policy orientation even back at that time, because we were a special entity, as we were called, kind of a composite entity. And that composite entity continued till 1947. And it is only after 1947 that diplomatic experience that we had gathered from 1919 and 1920 onwards and kind of added to the diplomatic initiatives that Nehru government undertook in 1947. So all that also comes into the story that I carry forward to the 21st century. So yes, it's a broad sweep of history that is covered in the book.
And of course, some of the chapters are more interesting than the others, and especially like for a reader like me, maybe, you know, like the women's the first women in the service, and you know what they had to go through, and also the outstanding characters among them who were of course from the elite sections like Vijayalakshmi Pandit and Leela Sarojini
Nilamani
Naidu.
Naidu.
Leelanmani Naidu, you know, and also that story about them not, you know, people can't get married, women can't get married unless, you know, they resign from the service. I mean, it made you think, wow, we've come a long way. But so that, and also the big chapter, the last chapter, you know, and the insights it gives into Jinnah, whose secretary he was in the pre-independence period. So, you know, I found the selection, and also the Wilson chapter, you know, it shows how people could emerge. They didn't have to come from elite, necessarily elite backgrounds, though a lot of them did. Some of them were like, you know, common people who just rose because of their ability. So tell me about the selection of, because of course these are the people you've chosen from many more. So what drove the selection process? You know, why did you choose to focus on these particular individuals? You know?
That's a very interesting question, Manjula. In fact, I often thought that perhaps someone, when in course of my discussion on the book, would ask me this question, you know, that why did I choose, say, for example, someone like Leelamani Naidu and Mr. Rashid Ali Beg? Because when I met Rashid Ali Beg's son, Murad, who now lives in Delhi, and he's known as a writer on automobile affairs.
Oh,
And
okay. Oh, that Murad. Acha. Okay.
yeah, Murad Ali Beg, yeah.
Okay.
So actually, I said that, you know, I would like to write about your parents. And Murad said, who remembers Tara Beg and Mirza Rashid Ali Beg? And I said that, you know, Murad, that your parents had very, very interesting lives. So when you asked me that, you know, why did I choose, say, for example, PRS Money, the Poonamani Ramakrishna S. Money, or why did I choose, say, for example, Leelamani Naidu or Rajeshwar Dayal? The fact is that, you know, not only that they were part of the first few batches of the Indian Foreign Service, but also because, to my understanding, they had very interesting lives. Because, you know, I'm not just writing about foreign policy professionals, because there are approximately 401 names in the history of services. But obviously, I can't write about every one of them. So when I started looking at the book, I really started looking into the fact that who among these people had a very interesting life. And by having an interesting life, I mean a combination of, say, all sorts of emotional ups and downs. Someone like, say, Dilip Kamtekar, who I have described as an outsider, because Kamtekar came from Baroda in 1950, 52. And Baroda was a very small city at that time. And when he came to the interview, you know, the elite band of boys who were present there, they basically looked at him and said, "Oh, thank God an outsider is here, because, you know, otherwise we had to perhaps recruit ourselves, because we are the elite of few privileged people." Because, you know, those days, Indian Foreign Service. Yeah, so exactly. So, you know, they're the sons of ICS officers, sons and princes of that kind, you know, and there was Dilip Kamtekar. So Dilip Kamtekar, when he came in, and there were lots of then subsequent stories about Dilip Kamtekar, and also, very interestingly, one of the factors that drove me to choose, say, for example, Eric Gonsalves, the first person, you know, who really carried out a crisis evacuation of Indians.
Yes.
Eric Gonsalves, I mean, he had such a fascinating career. I mean, he met with the CIA, initiated India's broken down relationship, I mean, sort of healed India's broken down relationship with the United States after the 1971 war. And so imagine, you know, an Indian diplomat meeting with a high official of the CIA after Indira Gandhi had a great fallout with Richard Nixon. And he was doing it all the while sitting in Washington, D.C. in a little cafe. So, I mean, to me, Eric Gonsalves had a very fascinating life, you know. So it is not just that these were important and successful diplomats, they were also very, very interesting characters, because they had very interesting lives. And when I mention, for example, Dilip Kamtekar, Now, Kamtekar's juniors always remember him as a very tough boss, you know, who was very unkind to them and who did not treat them nicely. So, you know, these are all characteristics, you know, that these are all features that fed into my understanding of this man, who perhaps had a very complex nature because he came from Baroda. He came from outside the set of favored few in those days. And he obviously had to work his way up in the ladder of service. So I felt, you know, these are the characters, you know, who must be chronicled. Now, for example, Leela Mani Naidu, because you mentioned Leela Mani Naidu, imagine being literally one female in the entire South Block in 1948,
yes,
and standing next to all these, you know, stalwarts, being the only lady figure in the office. And you are talking about, you're dealing with issues like whether India should recognize Israel. And
yeah,
that's the thing that Leela Mani Naidu was doing. So not only Leela Mani Naidu was a pioneer, and she was famous for having a, you know, very high temper, because she was known to have thrown files at her juniors who did not write notes properly, because she was, after all, a professor of English and philosophy from Hyderabad. So she would not take errors very kindly, but she was also very kind to her junior colleagues. You know, for example, Eric Gonzalez, when he was her protege in the ministry, he had faced some trouble and he went and sought help from Leela Mani Naidu. Leela Mani Naidu, who had this image of being this very tough taskmaster, helped very kindly this very young officer called Eric Gonzalez. So I found these characters to have so many layers and so many emotional dimensions to their lives, that I thought, you know, this is something that I must, these are the people that I must include in my story and in my narrative of the Indian Foreign Service. Now, one, Vijayalakshmi Pandit obviously was not a typical Indian Foreign Service officer. She was, after all, the sister of the Prime Minister. But then she was used as a very special kind of officer. Like, you know, there were three, four of them, like Krishna Menon and Vijayalakshmi Pandit. So when you are writing about the Indian Foreign Service and its narrative, you simply can't ignore these people. But then, you know,
yes,
when you have, perhaps you have also three, four other people that you could pick up. But I picked up Vijayalakshmi Pandit, not only because she was doing certain very outstanding work, but also because she had a very difficult personal life. I mean, she had fallen in love with a Muslim gentleman when she was barely 20, and then she had eloped and then come back, married off again, and then later on, you know, she rediscovered herself as a public intellectual when her brother was in prison. The entire family was literally broken up, and she was traveling all of the world, all the Western world. And then she again had come close to the same person who she had married as a teenager, you know. So, and so I felt that that Vijayalakshmi Pandit's life is so fascinating because of the pains and the problems that she faced despite being so-called quote-unquote privileged, that one must not forget such characters, you know, because they really opened the window into the problems and the advantages perhaps that they faced at that time. So I think, you know, they represent certain things which are much bigger than just their own careers and their preferences. That is why I perhaps automatically gravitated towards all these characters here.
Yes, I actually, that bit where you said and Syed Hussain gave her a platform for his own reason, for whatever reason, I marked it and laughed, because what could be his reason? You were back in touch. That is really, it kind of threw a light on how complicated. I mean, just, we sometimes think that, you know, people had easier lives, but, you know, back in the early days of India, but clearly the same problems persist. You know, this,
exactly. Also, I mean, subsequently, you know, the research about foreign policy writing and foreign policy professionals has focused on Muthamma, the Chonira Beliappa Muthamma being the first recruit. Now, the historic fact is that, yes, Chonira Beliappa Muthamma was our first recruit of the 1949 batch, because these were known as the competition walas. But then the truth is that Leela Mani Naidu had already joined the Indian Foreign Service, and she was not a youngster like, you know, Muthamma, because she was already in her 50s by the time she joined the Indian Foreign Service. And she was a reputed public intellectual, she was a professor, then, you know, she was a speaker and one of the biggest names of those days. In, you know, 1947, she was one of the most important coordinators of the Asian Relations Conference in Delhi. So, you know, I felt that someone like Nilamani Naidu is far more representative of, say, for example, the challenges that women faced at that time. I mean, where did we find women in government offices, and that too in some of the most important government offices like the South Bloc? And, you know, I felt really thrilled when I, and I, what I felt very astounding was that there are so few photographs of Nilamani Naidu. There are literally no photographs and very little writing. It's only in letters of Jawaharlal Nehru and Sarojini Naidu and also Leelamani's own writings here and there that we find some of the work that they had done. I mean, she had done. And I feel that these are the people who should be remembered because they are the foundational figures of the Indian Foreign Service.
And I suppose, I mean, you've not mentioned it in your book, but I suppose her sister's relationship with Nehru would also have been problematic for her in a way professionally, right?
Exactly. And, you know, there are this very interesting bunch of photographs about Padmaja. And, you know, these are all photographs taken inside Teenmurthy Bhavan, where Padmaja is standing with Leelamani. And these are quite unique photographs because in all these photographs, you can actually see that Padmaja is the more outgoing and she's the boisterous. She's a more flamboyant figure. And Leelamani is obviously appears as if she is quite conscious that she is a government official. She's not just here because her sister is, you know, a friend of the prime minister, but she also has a government duty to perform. So these are some of the photographs that I have seen. Obviously, you know, we could use all the photographs that we came across are also quite illustrative of this particular relationship that you're pointing out. You know, the Naidus were very secular, just like the Nehrus. And yet were very traditional. They represented a lot of the finer qualities of the society at that time. And it was a very unique interaction between the Naidus of the South and the Nehrus of the North, which also went into the making of this interpersonal mix. So, yeah, I see your point that her sister's presence, that also perhaps had some sort of a dynamic at work.
Very interesting. And also, like, you know, you made mentioned the Virendra, Virendra Chattopadhyay, Chatto, comes up. I mean, he's not sufficiently studied, right, for being eliminated by the Stalinists, right? So that was like really, I don't know, from your book, I thought, you know, there are many more biographies that should emerge, like of these figures who are understudied, I felt, you know, you've pointed them out.
The one thing that I have really felt is that the figures of the Indian freedom struggle were very, very quote unquote international in their thinking, in their way of life, in their social network, because they not only traveled, not just all of them traveled very extensively, but also that they had extensive network in the West. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, Nehru chose his friend, A.C. Nambiar, A.C. and, you know, that's Nehru Nambiar, as one of the first recruits in the early 1950s, because he felt that he has used Nehru's services for so long that perhaps it is this is a fitting tribute to Nehru's ability that he should serve as an Indian ambassador now, because Nehru had been living in Switzerland and Germany for the last 30 years. Now, similarly, when we talk about the Naidu family, Naidus were part of that international network, just like, you know, say, Raj Bihari Bose, perhaps, who went to Japan. So there were lots of these, and that is why I began my book with the example of the arms smuggling and that happened from Indonesia and Germany during the First World War, just to illustrate that, though we were not an independent country, but we were having international relations. You know, the international relation not only exists at the level of states, but also at the level of individuals. Like, you know, we also have friends, we have well-wishers in other countries. Maybe we have leaders and viewers in other countries. Similarly, you know, Sarojini Naidu also had a brother who was, you know, Virendranath Chattopadhyay, who was a revolutionary and a very melancholic person who had a very difficult life and was accused of being a spy by Stalin and then was eliminated by Stalin's police in the late 1930s. So all that basically feeds into your understanding of the world that you are living in. So if you are Leelamani Naidu or say Sarojini or Jawaharlal Nehru, all these factors that play the back of your mind that the world, the way it is, should be remembered, because this is what they can do to us if they are not friendly. So,
yes.
You know, so the risk and those challenges, one should remember, you know, what happened to Chatto also is part of our diplomatic, perhaps subtext or some sort of an underlying memory that is not always remembered, but that was a fact and that was discussed very widely in that part of the society back at that time. And it is very widely said that Sarojini Naidu's father felt very strongly that Mahatma Gandhi should appeal to Stalin to forgive his son. And for some misunderstanding, he felt that his daughter, that is Sarojini, did not try very hard. And as a result, he never forgave Sarojini Naidu. And he never spoke to Sarojini Naidu for the rest of his life. And Sarojini never forgave herself. So it was a very, very painful father-daughter relationship that continued for the rest of her life as well. It's a very, very painful part of our collective memory.
And, you know, I also, that bit about the Burma evacuation of Indians, you know, it's like a forgotten chapter, right? And I found that that section also kind of put, I mean, there have been various evacuations, and even before that, there was a whole march from Southeast Asia in back to India. And this is another, that is, I think, even better studied than this one. Okay? I thought this Burma evacuation in the immediate post-independence era is the first of many evacuations of Indians, expat Indians, that the government has carried out. Right? Now it's very familiar because of mass media. We know, oh my God, Ukraine, or, you know, this, that. But this is a long history.
Exactly.
So talk about that.
You know, it is not that Indians are getting into conflict zones for the first time. You know, Indians have been into conflict zones for as long as we can remember. You know, as Indians started traveling because of the invention of steamships, there were all these stories of Indians, how they faced the difficulties as indentured laborers, for example, in Fiji. When the Indian laborers went to Fiji and they were kept in very, very difficult circumstances, you know, in the middle of mosquito-infested marshland, you know, very shabby huts and etc., almost like slaves. But then, you know, when they wanted to leave, they couldn't because, you know, they were absolutely controlled by the white plantation owners. So, and Indians, of course, as we all remember, what happened in Southeast Asia during the Second World War was that when the Japanese walked into Southeast Asia, a lot of Indians felt that their lives were at risk and they had to be evacuated. But then our government at that time was not really our government. It was a colonial administration and they did not do anything. So what happened was that a lot of Indians basically walked back on foot through jungles and through river banks, and then they returned home. There comes this relation between your government and your citizens. So that is where the most unique relation comes into play. So when Jawaharlal Nehru is traveling to Malaya in 1946, he meets all these, you know, thousands of Indians, and they know that their government is not going to help them. But there they were, you know, they said, you know, we are so happy that now that we have a government, now we hope the government will do something. And Nehru felt at the time that he was actually powerless to do anything for all these thousands of Indians. But they felt that now at least we have a government which would listen to us. So that took little time for that government to help the Indian citizens facing difficulties abroad. And that is what happened when finally in 1963, the government of General Ne Win started expelling the Indians from Myanmar. The government of India felt that now at least we can send a ship to Myanmar and we can bring them back. So that is what happened finally. So you see, after a gap of nearly, say, 150 years, that is, the Indians were facing trouble situations abroad. And here, for the first time, you know, the government of India was making that effort to bring the Indians who are facing a distress situation abroad, you know, they were trying to help them so that they could be brought back. And finally, as Eric Gonzalez told me, that approximately 3 lakh plus population were brought back. But also a good number of them came through the forests, etc., through the Manipur border. And even now you have the Tamil community in Myanmar-Manipur border, which actually dates back to that evacuation. Because you know, when they were evacuated, they just reached India, and on landing India, they felt so happy. They just settled down there because they thought that, okay, this is where we have reached in India, and this is closest to Myanmar, so we could actually settle here. And you know, they were, because of the timber business, etc., that they were involved in, they felt that is a continuity of their past life. So what I'm trying to say is that the entire colonial and the post-colonial state formation, so there is this, you know, breaking point that, you know, here is the government which for the first time conveyed to its citizens that though we may not do much, but we will keep trying, so that next time when you face trouble, we will help you. So in 1946, India could not do much, though, of course, you know, the INA soldiers and prisoners who were imprisoned in Malaya and in Singapore after the Second World War were brought back in ships.
Yes.
And
yes,
they, of course, were rehabilitated. And many of them actually feature in my book because they also went on to join the Indian Foreign Service.
Yes.
So, for example,
yes,
Abid Hasan Tavrani, Cyril John Stracey, and the most importantly, K.M. Kannampilli, was a very, very fascinating character. Mr. Kannampilli, they all were INA soldiers. And they were, you know, colonels and captains of Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose. So this is most fascinating that, you know, today when we talk about, say, airlift from Iraq in 1990 or evacuation from Ukraine or Sudan, a few days back, we saw this, you know, little murmur happening about the Indian students facing difficulties in Kazakhstan. So the message was that Indian government must rush and airlift them. This was not normal 120 years ago. But once that the new government was formed after 1946 and 47, it slowly gradually became part of the culture of the new state that if Indians abroad are facing difficulty, then this is our moral duty and obligation to bring them back home. You know, it may be very difficult, but we have to try. So I think, you know, that is where we find the origin of this evacuation diplomacy that we see these days very often.
Mm. And, you know, it also made me think that, oh, we have come such a long way, in the sense that at that point, I mean, racism was so strong. Like, now, racism is still strong. But because of the existence of the Indian state, I mean, you know, other countries can't be so brazen about it, right? As they were before independence or immediately after, before the Indian state started asserting itself in this way, right? Then that's a large measure because of the foreign policy, you know?
Yeah, and also let us remember that racism is not just vis-a-vis the West. There are also other kinds of ethnic discrimination and other forms of discrimination that also broke out within the post-colonial societies. For example, when I write about Chandrasekhar Jha, Chandrasekhar Jha was part of the Indian initiative to understand what exactly was happening in Uganda and Kenya, because these are the post-colonial societies that were actually observing and getting inspired by the Gandhian struggle in India. But at the same time, they were also having difficult, relation with the Indians who were living in Eastern Africa and also in Southern Africa. They felt that Indians are smarter, Indians are doing really, really well professionally, and they had these, you know, difficult emotions as far as the Indians were concerned, and there began the racial discrimination against the Indians. So when India becomes independent and Indian people expect the government of India to do miracles for them, they are also putting the government of India, that is the Nehru government, on notice, saying that we are also going to observe how you treat our brothers and sisters who are facing difficulty in Kenya and Uganda.
Yes.
So the Indians in East Africa were facing a different sort of racial hatred. And therefore, Chandrasekhar Jha and some others had to travel to East Africa to discover what really was happening to the Indians. So you see, I mean, there are all these, because I always say that post-colonial, you know, decolonization is all, you know, part of our foundational principles, you know, all that. But then the fact is, decolonization is also a process which is full of impatience. You know, it's not known for being patient.
Yes,
so they also
that.
End up inflicting injustices on others because they are in a hurry to attain decolonization. So these are also part of that few tests that Indian diplomats had to do.
Yeah, so then, so I found like your book made me think and will make any reader think about all these things, you know, which is, which tells us why, you know, the Foreign Service is so important and, you know, and the role that it plays. So,
We often, the problem of history, or rather studying history, is that we often think of history from today's point of view.
Mm.
We always think, you know, what Nehru gave, what Nehru left for us. The issue is always for me, what Nehru really did to deal with the immediate challenges and the physical challenges that India faced in Nehru's lifetime.
Yes.
That is really the measure of whether, you know, how we look at Nehru's time. And what I feel is that when we look at history, we must always look at the physical reality that existed at a particular point in history that is being studied. And when I look back at foreign policy or foreign affairs of Prime Minister Nehru's period, I actually went back and focused on the physical realities that existed at the time. And the biggest physical reality, I asked myself, you know, was it really Pakistan? Was it China? Was it, say, India's relation with the Soviet Union or the United States? So what was really the biggest physical reality? The biggest physical reality of India in Prime Minister Nehru's time was hunger, was lack of food. And India's, the biggest diplomatic initiative of Prime Minister Nehru, if I really have to say, was his diplomacy about food.
Okay.
Because it came at a time when our entire food supply chain was disrupted by the Second World War, by the continuous disruption in the production cycle inside the country. And there was this Bengal famine that had taken place in 1943. And after the Bengal famine, the famine did not just disappear. I mean, it actually became a lingering famine of you know, multiple varieties. And if you remember, there were Malabar famine, there were, you know, even in Telangana, there was the mini famine, there was Orissa famine, Bihar famine. And of course, the whole country was basically facing a very grave threat that whatever happened in Bengal could actually break out across the country. So, and it would have been a devastating blow to the whole idea of India if soon after independence, India was to witness this recurrent famine-like situation.
Yes.
So the first project that the Nehru government had to focus on was the diplomacy on food, that is rice and wheat imports. And food was essentially, and it still is, a strategic commodity. As we see today, whether in Gaza or in Ukraine, people are facing starvation and people are having problems with the commodities market because food is something that is of daily necessity. So that food had to be acquired. And Nehru government reached out to various countries, like as I've written, in Indonesia to begin with, and then Argentina on the other side of the planet. Even Argentina supplied food, the United States supplied food. And of course, in the Western countries, there was a realization that India's food crisis was essentially a creation of the Allied war efforts. And it was not a creation of the Indian people. I mean, Indian people did not create the food crisis themselves on their own. It was a globally produced crisis that was unleashed on India.
Yes.
So when Indians were helping the West to fight the Second World War, we were also made to face this catastrophic situation on the food front. So I would say that, you know, did Nehru deal with the food crisis effectively? I mean, I cannot say Nehru dealt with it in an absolutely brilliant way, but I would say that yes, Nehru tried very hard to deal with the food issue, food security issue, and he reached out to all countries, and India's first diplomats were actually the food diplomats. So PRS Mani, Rajeshwar Dayal actually was one of the persons who, and the United Nations spoke for food for India. So, you know, I mean, these are very realities of that time that we really have to look at. And when we look at the realities of that time, only then we can really have a feel, have a grasp on the real problems that were besetting India. And then we can ask, did Nehru try his best. Did he succeed in addressing the most difficult issue, an issue that every Indian would face every day?
Yes.
And that's the issue of food, food insecurity. And the answer is, to me, yes, Nehru tried. Nehru tried.
You know, what your book has also brought out is that how, you know, now, I mean, with this great distance and, you know, we are so far away from it, we don't realize how the 1962 war impacted even foreign relations. And you brought that out very well. I mean, you know, and how other states started treating us less honorably, perhaps because of the, as a result, we think of, you know, the crisis that it brought on, but we don't think of this aspect. And immediately, you know, Burma treating Indians like that all that. So let's talk about that and the impact.
As I said, that we were facing a terrible food situation in mid-1940s as India was proceeding towards independence. So there is this, you know, interaction between India and Indonesia that is happening. And this diplomat called PRS Mani, who reaches out to the Indonesian leadership, Sultan Syahrir, and asks Sultan Syahrir whether Indonesia would like to send food assistance to India. And in return, India could give something to Indonesia. Now, of course, India gave commodities and some, you know, consumer items and textile items to Indonesia. And Indonesia was among the first countries to help India on the food front, number one. You see, but something that Indonesia did not have, and what's that's something very special that India had already by the mid-1940s, was the voice of India. Because India had already become a signatory to the United Nations Charter. But not just that, but even prior to that, India had participated in many international conventions and treaties. And as and more importantly, India's leadership was English speaking. So they had acquired popularity in the West. They were visible in the Western newsreels in countries like Sweden or Germany and Austria, Switzerland. So people in those countries who were at the forefront of various international movements were aware of whatever demands were coming from the Indian leadership. So when Indonesian leadership wanted to send rice to India, they very, obviously, very in a pragmatic way, also had their own expectations from India that since India has a voice and India can speak on our behalf with the West, let India also recognize Indonesia. And Indonesia was in a very difficult situation because during the Second World War, their leadership had collaborated with the Japanese. So they had become a little, you know, infamous for siding with the Japanese and etc. So they wanted to come out of that box. So the Indian leadership gave them that recognition, that political recognition came first from India, from Nehru government. So this particular voice of India was a great asset for the country. And, you know, because of Mahatma Gandhi, Nehru, and others, you know, including Sarojini Naidu, the widely well-known names in the West. So as India proceeded with the non-alignment movement, and remember the ideas like Panchashila were actually produced by the Indonesian leadership. It was actually Sukarno who gave us the idea of Panchashila. Basically, he was from a very mixed heritage to reflect the Panchapandava that Sukarno basically brought in Panchashila.
Okay.
But as the non-alignment movement and as all these episodes, the creative phase of Indian diplomacy was taking place, India's voice was also getting amplified. India was becoming known across the world. There was a lot of curiosity and a lot of, you know, talk about India's presence. So when and that is why, you know, the whole disappointment of this 1962 was that everyone thought India was this really an example to follow. India was doing great, you know, as far as diplomacy is concerned. But then you also expect India to remain strong as a friend of India. Countries like Indonesia, countries like, say, Sri Lanka, which were part of the non-aligned movement, they also expected India to be strong. But when the war happened with China, it was an awakening for everyone involved with the Indian experience. And they were actually disappointed that India, which was expected to be very strong because it was providing a very strong leadership when it came to ideas like decolonization. I mean, remember, decolonization was such a powerful movement that within days and months of the these big conferences and these big meetings that were happening, countries were becoming liberated in Africa, yes, in Latin America. So this was like, you know, kind of wave happening across the world. And in that middle, as you look up to India as a model of third world leadership, suddenly you discover that India was actually not as strong as it was expected to be. And there came the realization that, well, actually the stronger party here is China. And if we engage India, perhaps the Chinese are going to get antagonized. So therefore, a lot of countries dropped New Delhi from their traveling list. And India became, for a period of time, a soft target. And that is the tragic part of Nehru's life and also his diplomatic history, where you know, Nehru, of course, didn't stop being elegant because of the diplomatic setback. He was an elegant conversationist, and he continued to engage and send very elegantly drafted letters, even though his health was failing by the 1963 and 1964, early 1964. But it was a very clear moment to understand that, to remember that you may have the finest of soft power, the finest of diplomacy, and of course you would always have that very special voice that is inherited from our freedom struggle. But along with it, there has to be the realization that all of these must be protected in a very realistic framework with very strong defensive capabilities as well. So that is when, you know, the particular question that you asked, that, you know, how India was dropped from the list of travel by foreign leaders for a little period. And that is when the crisis with Myanmar happened, because 1962 November was the great setback. And soon thereafter, this problem in Myanmar escalated. And the rulers of Myanmar thought that since India is not in a position to do much, perhaps they could send back these lakhs of Indians who were sort of viewed as outsiders in Myanmar. And therefore, this great calamity that fell on the Indian citizens who were living in Myanmar at that time. So that's the story of the great evacuation that I have written. But, you know, the overall plot is that, you know, when India had this great voice in international relations, but perhaps India had not invested so much as to also build that muscle, the military muscle at that time. And therefore, there was my book essentially then leads towards the birth of Indian realism, because even as Nehru is fighting the war with the Chinese, he's also in talks with the Israelis to get more weapons from Israel. There is this, again, you know, realization that even though we may have these finer qualities, we must protect these qualities with, you know, very robust military preparedness.
Yes. I suppose that's what the 1962 debacle taught us, right? That you have to have a strong military, otherwise nobody respects you, really. I mean,
exactly. Especially because India's military was remarkable. I mean, India fought the Second World War, yes, and some of the victories of the Second World War were actually Indian victories, the victory of the Indian soldiers. So how can we not have in a great military power for our own defense? So that is the lesson of 1962, that we must be prepared to defend our country's interests, you know, at that whatever challenges we face.
Which also brings me to the story of the Battle of Surabaya, which is such a startling bit, that these guys, the Indian soldiers, were just sent by the British government into Indonesia with no inkling of what's happening there and expected to save the Dutch. I mean, you know, it's like shocking.
Yes. I mean, it really defies it defies your historical understanding of Second World War. Here was the great war, the civilizational war that the whole world was fighting. Our country, you know, we had no interest in the Second World War. Yes. And the provincial governments of 1937 actually resigned. People like Vijayalakshmi Pandit, and all of them resigned in protest after the Second World War. Yes. And when the government, the colonial administration, did not listen to our leaders, and when they demanded that now that the war has gone completely, you know, monstrous, and, you know, a lot of Indians are dying because this war is dragging our men to European battlefields and they are perishing in those battlefields. And at that point, when Mahatma Gandhi gave the call for the Quit India movement, all the national leaders were put in prison.
Yes.
And the reason that they were put in prison was that liberty is in danger. So freedom had to be safeguarded.
Yes.
And at the end of all that hardship and all that sacrifice by the Indians in the battlefields of the West and Southeast Asia and North Africa, when the time came to give give freedom to our countries in Asia, at that time, you know, at the time the British rulers essentially conveyed through their actions that now that the freedom in the West is safeguarded from attacks from Nazi Germany, so essentially the idea of freedom of Indonesia and thereby by implication the idea of freedom for India is not really a top priority for us, and
yes.
therefore the freedom movement in Indonesia could be crushed.
Yes.
And how were they planning to crush it was that they were bringing the Indian soldiers who were taken to Southeast Asia to fight the Japanese. And after defeating the Japanese, the same Indian soldiers were being now steered back to Indonesia, where their responsibility included crushing the Indonesian freedom fighters. So
yeah.
imagine that the duplicity of that moment, that here
yes.
were the Allied powers, the British government, which was promising us that freedom is just a few months away. And here they were doing this very sinister move to crush Indonesian freedom movement. And to me, it appears that if the British attempt to crush the Indonesian freedom movement been successful at that time, I think, you know, even the Indian freedom would have been delayed by several years. And I don't
yes.
think, you know, if you read Nehru's speeches, it gives the impression that there was suspicion in the air that perhaps this freedom that the British government, the Labour government at that time was promising us was not really real. Because if they succeeded, had they succeeded in crushing the Indonesian rebels in Surabaya and other places, then they probably would have turned at India and said, hey, listen, I think the freedom for India can wait a little longer. No, we need to protect our freedom in the West. And I think some of the most, you know, some of the very, very militant speeches of Prime Minister Nehru came, I mean, of course, in a little before he became the leader of the interim government in late 1945. He was out of prison, traveling across the country, and he literally was threatening the British government to leave, and also threatening that if they did not leave, then there is going to be a very huge, catastrophic, region-wide war to fight the colonial oppressors. So I think, you know, there's this whole lot of uncertainty. There is this food insecurity, you know, lack of political structure, continuous humanitarian crisis, dislocation of masses of individuals from one place to the other, communal riots. So you have to really look at that historical, framework, and then ask the question that how did the state of India establish itself in the middle of this sort of, you know, crazy madness that was unfolding in South Asia, in particular, in Southeast Asia included, and of course, the world in general. And therefore, this whole notion that the state had to be established in a very neutral manner, and the bureaucracy has to be safeguarded. And along with that bureaucracy, we must have a diplomatic arm that would be firefighting for us in all the important locations across the world. So that is how the Indian Foreign Service came into the picture, because there were so many dynamics that were clashing against each other at that point. It was humanly simply not possible to safeguard India's freedom at that point. And I think the biggest challenge was to safeguard India's freedom from further colonial encroachment and to ensure Indian people were, first of all, provided basic means of livelihood like food.
Yes.
So I think that is the context in which India's diplomacy started. And of course, you know, by 1962, then the whole idea of realism sets in. And that's a journey that Nehru and his administration completes during the next 17, 18 years.
And, you know, talking about communal violence, this whole section, the last chapter on Mirza Rashid Ali Beg, sort of, I mean, I was reading it and I was thinking, secular Muslims, this is the challenge that they've faced right from the beginning of the Republic, right? You know, And that they've had to, like, he being a secretary to Jinnah and coming face to face with the way Jinnah thought and rejecting that. You know, there's we know so many you know, people who reject that sort of conservative you know, idea, orthodox idea. You know, so let's talk about that and what a challenge it was for him as well, right?
You see, Mirza Rashid Ali Beg, of course, he had a particular social background which
Yes.
was plural. He came from a very cosmopolitan background. He was widely traveled. He had traveled to the West. He traveled in London and lived there. And so, therefore, he had the exposure to the broader world, and so did Muhammad Ali Jinnah,
So did he,
and
yeah.
so did Pranavita Nehru.
Yeah.
So what really comes across is that Mirza Rashid Ali Beg was essentially surprised that both he and Jinnah had the exposure to the, or rather the benefit of having lived in a more wider cultural milieu,
Yeah.
and having lived in that milieu, had learned and benefited from that milieu enormously. And they were
Yes.
both aware that it is far more beneficial and far more enriching to live a life that is pluralistic in nature. And that is why perhaps it comes across from Mr. Rashid Ali Beg's life that he was struck by the fact that despite knowing the advantages of this pluralist model, Jinnah was pushing for this very exclusivist
Yes.
model of statehood for what Jinnah said, the Indian Muslims. So it was something that he did not appreciate, that having lived that cosmopolitan life and having enjoyed that and also benefited from it, and also having empowered themselves because of that cosmopolitan exposure, how can you push your own people into this exclusivist, narrow way of living and thinking? So I think there was the first differences between Jinnah and Mirza Rashid Ali Beg, because Rashid Ali Beg very clearly felt that Jinnah was basically being very self-serving. He was essentially a very self-serving, at times highly authoritarian, leader who was mesmerized by the fact that just a call by Muhammad Ali Jinnah could mobilize millions of people. And that, of course, creates its own addiction to power. Perhaps it can mesmerize of a person and also make him feel enormously powerful. And that is something that Mirza Rashid Ali Beg was uneasy about giving so much power to just a single person. And he felt that it is not a direction which was going to fetch a good results for the Indian Muslims. And that is why he chose to stay in India. I mean, there were family members of his who chose to go over to Pakistan, which was a very different Pakistan from what we have today across the border.
Yes.
It was, of course, a very cosmopolitan Pakistan, even back then, in the 1950s and all that. So I would say that the main issue was that both Mirza Rashid Ali Beg and Jinnah belonged to the same section of society, where they could see each other, that Jinnah was actually being self-serving. He was not working out of your love for his quote-unquote Indian Muslims. And that's something that Mirza Rashid Ali Beg caught Jinnah doing. And therefore, he tried to sabotage it through his writing, even when he was his secretary. And Jinnah had already suspected him that he actually has sympathies with the nationalist figures like Gandhi, Nehru, and Patel. So he would check the drafts that Mirza Rashid Ali Beg would make, and he would correct those things like communities. And instead of Hindu and Muslim communities, he would always say Hindu and Muslim nations. So that's Jinnah's eccentric editorial decisions that Beg also had to deal with.
Not so eccentric. I mean, I'm sure Pakistanis
Yeah,
won't agree with
yeah,
that
exactly.
word. But of course, you know, and so then it made me also think of how, like, right from, I mean, I don't know, the early 20th century, Indians, whether Muslims or Hindus, since we are the, you know, two majorities in the subcontinent, we've always been grappling with this battle between secularism and, you know, like very orthodox, very orthodox ways of thinking. And that is a struggle for us. Like, it's perennially been a struggle. And at some point, one side emerges stronger, and at the other point, and I mean, and how a personal life feels depressed or joyous is based largely on your political, feelings.
You know, I mean, this really goes back in time. It goes back in time, not just to the early 20th century, but also to the introduction of Western education in India. Going back even to 1830s and 1840s, when Indians were actually traveling abroad in the steamships. So all the talks about, say, Ram Mohan Roy going to London and Bristol, and Prince Dwarkanath Tagore, that's Rabindranath Tagore's grandfather, and the people of that time, you know, who traveled, you know, they had to again come back, and they had to undergo, which was known as the purification process, because you were not even supposed to cross the oceans. So these are essentially cultural problems that, or challenges that our society had been dealing with for nearly 100 years or so by the time the nationalist movement really peaked. And so they also had to deal with it. You know, when Gandhi returns from South Africa, instead of making him do the prayaschit or purification process as Orthodox Hindus would have required him 100 years earlier, here they were welcoming him. So it was again some sort of improvement had taken place. So there we see that, you know, Gokhale going to Gandhi and asking him to take over the leadership role in the national struggle. And here he was, after all, an immigrant, or rather a former immigrant who had returned home. And here he was leading the Indian freedom movement. And then again, all his career, I mean, throughout the next 40 years, and including his assassination, this continuous play of religion and politics, that is something that is perhaps part of the Indian existence, and we can't really wish it away. And these things, you know, whether the state formation or freedom struggle or any other segment of the last 100 years history, will be marked by the dynamics unleashed by, say, these orthodox versus liberal attitudes and debates and discussions, as it is happening even now.
Yes, even now. K.R. Narayanan is like a fascinating person. I mean, you know, like I find him fascinating because he's from where my mother is, the same area, Ottapalam, that's where he rose from. So, you know, like my family is from there. So I found that, you know, I've always wanted to know what his trajectory of his life was, because he was not born in, you know, in an upper caste family at all, unlike a lot of the diplomats you speak about. So,
this chapter called the Rebels and Princes.
Yes.
So in this chapter, I write about him, and I actually wrote about him as well as a prince. I basically juxtaposed his life with the life of this prince from Kodda Sangani. So there's this prince called Pradyuman Singhji, Kodda Sangani, and they both were Indian consuls, consul generals in North Vietnam and South Vietnam. So Kodda Sangani was in South Vietnam, and K.R. Narayanan was in North Vietnam. So I just juxtaposed them because, you know, it's very fascinating that here was a prince who was eccentric, and he had his share of controversies and etc. And here was this, you know, person who essentially came from the Dalit background in Kerala. And that is K.R. Narayanan. And he was, even by that time, you know, early 1960s, K.R. Narayanan was a very mature thinker and a very measured official.
Yes.
And perhaps, you know, 15 years down the line, we find him going to China as the Indian ambassador after, the relation between New Delhi and Beijing normalized. So I did not, of course, elaborate on his life in a great measure, but then I included him into the narrative because it's a fascinating life. Because, you know, the Nehru's approach was that the Indian Foreign Service must reflect the Indian society. So if you have the likes of, say, the ICS officers, then you must also have the people who are not so privileged. So there were these underprivileged people who were brought in. And K.R. Narayanan was remarkable even by that time, because he came from, he was the student of Harold Lasky, and he had actually interviewed Mahatma Gandhi as a journalist.
Yes.
And interviewing Mahatma Gandhi used to be the really the toughest assignment of that time. And when I was searching, somebody told me about the presidential period of K.R. Narayanan in the Rashtrapati Bhavan. And sometimes he would ask his team to bring out the statements of Mahatma Gandhi and Prime Minister Nehru, so that whatever statements that he would make as the Indian president in the late 1990s would be in sync with the remarks that Mahatma might have made.
Oh.
So that tells you that how they carried that national tradition and how that history actually moved through individual to individual, irrespective of the position that they were responsible for. And so I think, you know, it's very interesting that, again, you mentioned that your family comes from the same area. And like K.R. Narayanan, I have also focused on this man called Santosham John Wilfred.
Yes, yes, perfect, fantastic. Yeah, that's a fantastic chapter.
Yeah, so, you know, but just, it was, so as Nehru told Girja Shankar Bajpayee, that create a service which will reflect India. And as I was telling you that, you know, how a young boy from Baroda had come to join the Indian Foreign Service in 1952, and he discovered that the service was recruiting, you know, just four candidates were to be recruited that year, and almost all the four were from highly privileged background. And yeah, here was a man who was a stenographer from,
yes,
of all places, from Vellore in Tamil Nadu.
Yeah.
Of course, it was not even Tamil Nadu at that time, it was the Madras Presidency.
Yes, yes.
And he came from Vellore. It took him 7 days to travel to Delhi. And Delhi was facing this, you know, Hindu-Muslim communal riot, and he and his family arrived in Delhi railway station. Imagine the journey that a stenographer from Vellore in 1948, you know, coming with his family to this, you know, violence-torn city, was,
yeah,
witnessing. And as,
yeah,
soon as he arrives, within 3 months, Mahatma Gandhi himself is assassinated.
Yes.
And yet, this man, just like, you know, K.R. Narayanan himself, of course, K.R. Narayanan was much better educated because he came from London School of Economics, having traveled and lived abroad. But Santosham John Wilfred was, after all, just a clerk in the government,
yes,
of India. And,
yeah,
then he went on to become an ambassador in the next,
yes,
15 years.
Yes.
So I think, you know, that in the spirit of inclusion, that spirit of giving chance to the person who had that ability in him, these are the things that made the service and also the atmosphere around these individuals very, very, rich and very promising.
Yeah.
So the stories, therefore, always fill us with a lot of hope.
Yes.
I mean, in fact, during the recent book launch, one of the speakers said, this is a very reverential book. And I felt that, you know, I said that, you know, if you really look at these lives, then the only feeling that you have is that, how could they deal with so many problems and challenges in their lifetime?
Yes.
I mean, today we don't have to think about food security as much as Indians, even middle-class Indians had to think in the mid-1940s.
Yes. Yeah. The whole ration system was because of that.
Yeah. So today we don't have to think about it. At least middle-class India does not,
yeah,
have to think so much about those basic issues of bread and livelihood. Of course,
yes,
I mean, unemployment is still a major, major issue in India. But then for the period that we are talking about, the whole formation of the post-colonial state and the challenges that they were facing, and yet the lives that these characters had lived, had only, you know, evokes only one feeling, and that is of great reverence. You know, I'm not, that's why I felt that, yes, of course, it is a reverential book because these lives are so special, and how can we not be filled with anything but reverence when we study them or even look at them?
Yeah, and all the chapters, even the chapter on stenographers, you know, that is a great chapter. So it was like usually we, like you've mentioned in the book, you people concentrate on the top rung and, you know, the creamy sort of people, but this is the rank and
absolutely
file, the guys who do the hard work, the note taking, and fantastic. You know,
absolutely,
you really brought that out.
Yeah.
I really loved that,
yeah,
chapter. You know, so
yeah, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, when the government or rather the state was formed, the issue was documentation, giving orders, writing, taking notes. And those were not done always by the officials. I mean, even look back at that time and you will find even Prime Minister Nehru himself was a great, if I can say, draftsman. I mean, he used to write, he used to take his own notes. So writing was a skill. Writing was essential for the creation of the post-colonial state of India. And that is why the stenographers, you know, especially from the people from Kerala and Tamil Nadu, you know, these are very, very special. No, and also very, you know, great bunch of them came from certain districts, from you know, Palakkad and others. You know, they were known that they are from Palakkad, so he has to be a good stenographer. So that is very important, and that is why when we talk about big IFS officers and big ICS officers, I always remember that we also have to remember the stenographers, because the stenographers were the ones who are creating the orders, giving shape to the written text. All that. So that is why I dedicated a chapter to them here.
Excellent. You know, Karol, I could keep talking to you because I really love the book, and I think that it's like an important, you know, it's really an important book, and I enjoyed reading it. And it's also, like I said earlier, it's very instructive, and it kind of makes the reader understand how much we've traveled, and possibly, you know, make you also think about, well, you know, how much we will also travel going forward. So, you know, thank you so much for talking to me. And
thank you so much, Mandela, and thank you so much for giving space to Nehru's first recruits. Thank you.
So for the listeners, go out and get Nehru's First Recruits, The Diplomats Who Built Independent India's Foreign Policy by Kalol Bhattacharjee. It is an excellent book. It's really well written, and it'll really open your eyes to many things about our history, and it's fascinating reading. Thank you so much, Kalol.
Thank you once again. Thank you.
Bye. Bye.
Bye-bye.
To stay updated on this podcast, follow us at HT Smartcast on all the major social media platforms. To listen to more such podcasts, log on to www.htsmartcast.com.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Wake up to a delicious morning with your favorite McDonald's breakfast sandwiches, now just $2, only in the app. Choose from a bacon, egg, and cheese biscuit, sausage McMuffin, or bacon, egg, and cheese McGriddles, just $2, only in the app. That's a deal as irresistible as the sandwiches themselves. Plus, you'll save time by ordering ahead in the app. Offer valid one time per day from July 29th through September 1st at participating McDonald's. Must opt in to rewards.